I'd like to introduce our special speaker now before she starts the service a bit later. January, a year ago, I invited the Reverend Dr. Marilyn Sewell to come from our Portland church and do a women's seminar for us and preach. It's very rare that we get to invite one of our star ministers to come and spend this kind of time with us. She has accomplished an awful lot since I knew her in the 80s. She received her PhD in theology and the arts from the Theological Union at Berkeley, her Master's of Divinity from Starr King, her Master's in English Lit, a Master's in Social Work, BA in English Education. I told the folks yesterday that she has more degrees than anybody I know, and that's really true. She's edited several books on women's spirituality and poetry. We have her books available for sale, and she's available for signing after the service. So you might want to check those out. She's been recognized as a UU Scholar and a John Haynes Home Fellow, won the Feminist Theology Award in 89, named A. Powell Davies Preaching Fellow for Excellence in Preaching. In 2000, at our General Assembly, where 4,000 of us gather, we gathered in Nashville, Tennessee, that year. She was the speaker at the service of the Living Tradition, which is a big honor for her. So she's been an English teacher, a therapist, a TV personality, and is now minister and spokeswoman. She's earned her reputation as a dynamic leader, not only in the UU church, but in the spiritual and political community at large.
Thank you, Sharon. And we are still beautiful. Right, ladies? All right. Let's open the service here then. We come to this house of worship this morning to renew our faith in the holiness, goodness, and beauty of life, to be reminded of our highest aspirations, and to know once again that we are not isolated beings, but connected in mystery and in miracle to the universe, to this community, and to one another. Come now and let us worship together. We see these many candles. We see the many concerns that we hold. Will you pray with me? Spirit of life, we come this morning, as always, with so many concerns on our hearts. Let us begin with thanksgiving. Thanksgiving for the many blessings in our lives, the material blessings, the blessings of the season, the blessings of opportunity. We know that some here today are struggling with illness. Others are struggling with loss and disappointment. Others are concerned about friends, relatives. May they be comforted. And may those who need to be healed, may those be healed, whether those wounds are emotional wounds or physical wounds. Our hearts are also heavy with our nation's wrongs. We want our nation to be right. And we grieve with the constant death of this war. But we're here in community. So may each person here today know that he or she is not alone. And may each person here find their own particular path of service, their own way of giving, that person might bless the world with their gifts. For that is the way to live with joy. It is the way to live with good purpose and with meaning during the days that we have been given on this earth. We ask this in the name of the good and the holy. Amen. This is my first visit, and I know not my last visit to this amazing city that you have here. Austin is fabulous, and I've seen just bits and pieces of it, thanks to my good friend Sharon Moore and her husband Brian, who have so graciously welcomed me into their home and have shown me around the city. I hope that I'll be invited back here to your church, which I've enjoyed tremendously being here with the women over the weekend and then today in the church service. So you have a wonderful thing going here in the city and in this church. So I'm very grateful to be here. I want to speak just briefly to the men before I begin this service. I have kind of an apology to make because, you see, this sermon, what women really want, is the first of a two-part series, really, because the second sermon, which would be preached the next Sunday, would be What Do Men Want? And I did preach that sermon at my own church, and I met with the men ahead of time, and I talked with them and took notes, and then I tried to speak to their concerns the next Sunday. And, of course, I won't have the opportunity to do that, to meet with you men, but I want to tell you that I know that you have your special concerns as well. I also want to say that the difficulties that women have in this culture are systemic to the culture, and so I'm warning you men, don't take this personally, okay? In anything that I say, because actually men and women buy into the assumptions of the culture, and we all do that because that's just the way human beings are in a culture, in a society. But we need to question those assumptions, and that's what this sermon is about, to questions the assumptions of the dominant paradigm of patriarchy. So that's what it's about. It's not about not liking men. I was just thinking, when I was preparing this sermon, that I have probably four people who I would consider my mentors, and three of those are men, wonderful men, who have stood by me and have helped me along the path. So I want to just say that at the very beginning. Now, I grew up in North Louisiana in a little town called Homer near Shreveport. It's not too far from the Texas border. And so I expect that I share a lot with many of you, culturally speaking. I was raised by my grandparents. I attended a Southern Baptist church three times a week because that's what you do in a small town in the South. And I went to a little high school that had only 47 graduates in the senior class. Now, it was in my senior year that a lifelong pattern clearly emerged, a pattern that has left me conflicted, really, all the rest of my life. Now, that year, I was elected best Christian and most intelligent. Plus, I was named Miss Betty Crocker Homemaker of the Year. Now, these are all the titles, of course, most sought after by an adolescent girl. And all these three arenas, the spiritual, the intellectual, the domestic, have ever since been vying with one another for time and attention. Like many women, I have tried to bring a balance to all of these various dimensions of my life. Now, the message that I kept getting from the culture all around me was to get small. Now, I tried to take on the role of the Southern Belle, but ruffles and bows never quite looked right on me. I mean, I was almost 6 feet tall. So getting small was really not an option, not physically and not intellectually. I loved learning, and I just kept going to school. I mean, even my own mother, practically on her deathbed, this is what she said to me. She said, "Why do you keep going to school?" She says, "I don't care what the libbers say." She says, "A man has to feel dominant. If you keep getting these degrees, you'll never find a man," she said. Yeah, well, what can I say? She was right. And then there was the man who told me, after a relationship of many years, he said, "When I first met you, you were a fragile flower, and now you're more like a tree." He said, "It's hard to love a tree." So the message that I got again was, get small. That old message again, be a fragile flower if you want to be loved by a man. Don't be strong. Well, what do women want? A presumptuous title, of course, because I cannot speak for all women. I've told you a little bit of my own experience of who I am and where I have been. And, of course, my own experience colors everything that I say. But in this congregation are women of all ages. They're lesbian women and straight women. They're bisexual women. They're single women and married women. They're mothers here. They're women who have never given birth. There are women who have chosen traditional paths. And there are others who are striking out in new and bold directions. There are differences of race. There are differences of class. All those are differences that make all of us, not have the same message. And yet there are commonalities, I believe. And I hope that those commonalities will emerge, at least in part, in my remarks today. One thing that women have in common is that we are vulnerable physically. 1 in 6 women is sexually assaulted sometime in her lifetime. 1 in 10 have experienced violence from their partners. Now, if I asked, and I will not do this, of course, but if I asked the women who have had some experience of sexual molestation or sexual abuse or rape or violence from their partners, if I asked them to raise their hands today, I would guess that at least half of the women in this congregation would raise their hands. Domestic violence is the single largest cause of injury to women in the United States, the single largest cause. The single most common occasion for female homicide is an argument with a man. And it's not just the men at the bottom of the economic heap who are violent toward women. Domestic violence occurs on all social classes. Now, why all this violence against women? Is there something about the way women are denigrated in this society that gives men the permission to hurt women? As a woman, I would like to feel safe. And I do not always feel safe. As a woman, I want our political leaders to pass laws which make women and children and families a priority, and then to fund those laws. In every election, we hear a lot about family values, and the people who speak the loudest about that are usually talking about, "Oh, well, we don't want gay marriage." That's not what I'm talking about when I talk about family values. Let me say this loud and clear. I am for family values, and this is what I mean. I want prenatal care for every pregnant woman. I want to be sure that babies and young children get the nutrition that they need, which they don't always, because almost 20% of our children are still living below the poverty line. I want quality child care when both parents have to be in the workplace, or a single mom has to be in the workplace. I want a Head Start program that will serve all eligible children, because we know that those programs work for children, but only a fraction of them get to go to Head Start. And we are the only industrialized country that doesn't guarantee some sort of paid leave to new mothers. More than 160 countries do so, but not the United States. Only 7% of employers offer at least 6 weeks of maternity leave with at least some pay. Only 7% in our country. As a woman, I would like to receive equal pay for equal work and an equal chance at advancement. Although a number of women have been spotlighted recently as they have moved into prominent positions in business or political life, for example, the first female Secretary of State, the first female President of Princeton, the first female Speaker of the House, the fact is that these achievements do not reflect what is happening to most women. The pay gap between men and women who have similar qualifications and who work in the same occupation has barely budged since 1990, and that pay difference is women make about 75 to 80% of what men make, with, note, similar qualifications in the same occupation. As the first female minister of a church, which was founded in 1866, I ran into some interesting questions when I was pre-candidating. Now, you should know that pre-candidating is how we refer to the extensive interviews that a potential minister has with a search committee who's looking for a new minister to fill the pulpit, for those of you who don't know that. Well, I pre-candidated 10 times before I took the church in Portland, Oregon. I was going to keep looking until I found the right church. And in many of those interviews, I was asked this question by some member of the search committee. I was asked, "Do you think that you, as a woman, can minister to men?" Now, the committee from Portland did not ask that question. You know, later on, I told that story to my congregation, and I said to them, "Now I ask you, when have women not ministered to men?" Can you imagine that a man would be asked that question? You know, can you, as a man, minister to women? Nobody would think of asking that question. Oh, well. To continue. As a woman in relationship, I would want my partner to share equally in nurturing and caring. We know that in dual career families, the wife still generally does a much greater percentage of the domestic work. We sometimes just fall into these patterns without thinking, because housework, childcare, and food preparation are not paid in the marketplace. These activities are somehow relegated to the less important. They are, in fact, described by economists as at-leisure activities. I went to a lecture recently, and that's what this economist told us. I thought that was pretty funny. Actually, though, what could be more crucial to human well-being than the physical and emotional nurturing of family members? Women are the ones who so often weave the cloth that holds the social networks together. They are the ones who give the birthday parties and write the thank you notes, who take the food to the bereaved widow, who have the relatives in for a Thanksgiving dinner. We involve ourselves with other people's lives and well-being in very specific and concrete ways on a daily basis. Now, this doesn't mean that men never do many of these things, but women are acculturated to take on these roles. And these activities create the relational ties that make life meaningful. But because women take on so much of this significant unpaid and unrecognized work, we often neglect our own personal predilections and passions. We make light of our gifts, and we fail to develop them all too often. One of my congregants told the story of her favorite aunt, who was an artist, coming over for a visit, and she asked to see this woman's paintings. Well, this congregant had her work stuffed under the bed and in the closet. She pulled a painting out, and the aunt said, "What is the title?" Well, there was no title. And then she pulled another one out, and again the question came, "Well, what's the title?" And again, there was no title. And the woman began crying and shaking. She confessed to her aunt, "I think my art is selfish." She began to understand in that moment that she must use her gifts, else they would turn against her. That is just a truth of human life. If you have gifts that are unused, they will turn against you. They will cause depression or they will cause aggression. You must use those God-given gifts. Now, this story is so typical, so understandable. Women are taught to please others, to take care of others' needs. And who knows, perhaps some of this caretaking tendency is also biologically determined. I don't know. But we often end up feeling selfish when we move to develop our own talents or to create an identity of our own. To continue, as a woman, I want to be valued all the more as I grow older and wiser. Now, women are now denying that old degrading message: a woman's worth is in her youth and her beauty. What is beautiful? A young woman, yes, is beautiful. And then there's beauty of the middle-aged woman. And then there's the great beauty of age. The great beauty of age. Advertisers put forward a picture of what women are supposed to look like. And the models get thinner every year. So thin, in fact, that a few of them have died of anorexia. And the industry is beginning to reconsider what it is asking of these young women. All people want to be wanted, want to be loved. And so too many women still these days are buying very expensive and useless skin creams, having Botox injections and getting radical plastic surgery. Some even, and I read this article in the New York Times, if you will believe this, some women are going so far as having parts of their feet cut off so they can wear more fashionable shoes. I remember a scene from the movie Bus Stop, a classic movie starring Marilyn Monroe, the quintessential sexual icon who was used and abused by so many men, famous and not so famous alike. I was taken by a portion of the film in which she seems to be speaking as herself, not as an actress. She's talking to a woman friend about men, and she says poignantly, she says, "You know what I want from a man?" She says, "Not all that loving stuff. I want a man to respect me." What do women want? To be seen and accepted as whole persons, not something to be used to satisfy a man's needs, sexual or otherwise. Now, let me speak to the men in the congregation. Like the women here, you all are at different places in regard to these gender matters. But I think all of us, myself included, women as well as men, buy into cultural assumptions more than we would like to believe that we do. And they are assumptions, and too often they go unquestioned. Now, in an article on male supremacy, a woman named Harriet Gill suggests some questions that men might ask of themselves to get a kind of perspective on their attitudes, a kind of checklist to indicate where they are in relating to men. And I thought that I might share that list with you this morning. So, men might ask themselves these questions. When a woman is raped by a man she knows, do I conclude that it is really not rape? Do I think that my work is more important than my wife's work or my partner's work? Am I uncomfortable in the face of female authority? Do I monopolize conversations with women, talking mainly about myself, showing little curiosity about her thoughts? Do I expect personal service from women, such as housework, valet service, running errands? Do I expect women to defer to me? Do I take a woman seriously when she says, "I want to talk about our relationship"? What is my attitude toward women in the workplace? Do I give the women in my life the same emotional support that I hope to get from them? What do women want? It was interesting to me to see that Marilyn Monroe and Chaucer's Wife of Bath had much the same answer. Now, in Bus Stop, a handsome but naive young cowboy falls for Marilyn Monroe. Trouble is, he tries to wrestle her to the ground in the same way he wrestles a prize steer, with brute strength and with determination to control her. She pulls back, and she makes ready to leave. And then he becomes tender and gentle, and he lets her know that he cherishes her. And of course, she falls into his arms and says that she wants to stay with him forever. Well, I love those happy endings. Now, in the Wife of Bath's tale, if you remember from long ago, I haven't read that recently either, but if you remember, a knight from King Arthur's court ravishes a maid and is condemned to death. The queen, though, gives him a way out. She says, "I will grant you life if you can tell me what it is that women desire most." The knight has 12 months to find the answer. So he goes everywhere searching for what it is that women most desire. But everybody seems to have a different opinion. Some say honor. Others say mirth. Some say lusty husbands. Others say rich array. Now he despairs as time grows short. And then he comes upon an old, wizened woman. She promises to give him the answer, but he must promise to do the first thing that she requires of him. So he agrees. He goes back to the court, and he says to the queen, "My liege lady, over all this world, women wish to have sovereignty over their husbands as well as over their lovers, and to be in mastership above them." Well, there was neither wife nor maid nor widow who rejected this answer, and all declared he was worthy to have his freedom. But now here's the tricky part. The ugly old woman asks that he take her as his bride. "Oh, anything but that," he says. But she is adamant. "No, this is what I'm asking." So he marries her, but in great distress. Then she says, "Well, choose one of these two things. You can have me foul and old until I die, and to you, a true and humble wife, never displeasing you, or else you can have me young and fair, and you take your chances." His answer, he says to her, "My lady and my love, do which may be the greatest pleasure and greatest honor to you. I care not which of the two, for it suffices me as it pleases you." "Then I have mastery over you?" she asks. "Yes," answers the knight. And then, you guessed it, he kisses her in her present reality. That's the key. He kisses her in her present reality as she is, and she turns into a fair young woman. And the ending goes like this. "And she obeyed him in all which might cause him delight or pleasure. And thus they lived in perfect joy to the end of their lives." Now, when his greatest concern becomes to honor her and please her, she gives herself to him without reservation. What would it be like if we decided to partner this way? What if control and dominance of the partner, whether male or female, gay or straight, we're given up for respect and love for the partner as that person is. And what if the greatest pleasure of each was to please the other? That key phrase is as that person is, because when we accept that person as that person is, not only does the love come to us, but also the blooming of that person happens, as it does symbolically in the story. The blooming, the beauty of the person happens when that person is not bullied, or we try to change that person, but when that person is accepted as that person is and loved as he or she is. What does a woman want? A partner who will help her find her true names. Friends who will cherish her spirit and see her beauty and remind her of her goodness. A community of people who will take joy in her power and take pleasure in seeing her grow and flourish. If she is so fortunate to be blessed in this way, then she will be able to give her good gifts from a heart that is secure and unafraid. May it be so for every woman, and may it be so for every man. Amen.